This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia, the podcast where we visit with authors and other bookish folks about information located beyond the page. This episode features a nice chat I had recently with Laura Barnett about her first novel, The Versions of Us. The book actually features three stories that focus on one couple, Eva and Jim. The stories vary quite differently because at some random point during each story, a seemingly harmless decision was made which altered the course of our characters. And instead of presenting one version of their life together in its entirety before moving on to the next, Laura shares three different beginnings, followed by three versions of what happened next, and so on, making for a very careful read. Laura spoke with me via Skype from her home in England.
And I meant to tell you that this would be just the audio and no video, but I forgot.
Oh. So. That's all right. I've just done my makeup, but no worries. Hey, I can use it this evening.
You put on makeup for me. Thanks.
Now, when I speak with authors about the characters in their books, I like to be extra careful about making sure I pronounce the names of the characters correctly. So if you haven't read The Versions of Us yet, here's how Laura refers to her cast
Jim
of characters.
And Ava. Is it Ava? Is that how you pronounce it?
It's Eva.
Eva, okay.
I think, strictly speaking, you're correct. I think in Eastern Europe, where it's a common name, it would be said Ava, but in English, I say Eva. But we can say either.
We will say Eva. That Jim, if not with Eva, would be attracted to, okay, now Heidi, is it Helena? Helena? How would you say?
Helena.
Helena.
Yeah.
Or that Jim, if not with Eva, would be attracted to, now I forgot what you just said. How do you pronounce it?
I was slightly less awkward during the rest of the interview. Here's our conversation. Your book, The Versions of Us, consists of three different life scenarios for Jim and Eva, whose initial meeting hinged on the position of Eva's bicycle tire to a rusty nail. Do you have an elevator speech to describe your novel?
I do, sure, yes. I've had to hone that over the last sort of year or so. So, yes. You gave a very good, succinct description, but I'll try and give my own elevator speech. So, The Versions of Us is a love story, or strictly speaking, I should say it's three love stories. So, through the novel, we follow the relationship between two people, Eva and Jim, across three different trajectories, moving from the late 50s, when they first meet or don't meet in Cambridge as students, through to the present day when they're in their 70s. And the novel takes in all the stuff of life and love, from meeting and falling in love to getting married to each other and to other people, childbirth, child rearing, you know, the highs and lows of careers, family. So there's a lot in there, and it's about the moments that define our lives, really, the times when we take one path over another, and that has an effect on the whole passage of our life.
I had wondered if the three different life scenarios that involved Jim and Eva were written as individual attempts at a single novel, but then I saw a promotional video for the book. You explained that you wrote the book chronologically, writing each of the three potential scenes as they would have played out next. Did you always know that the specific characters would follow specific paths, like the lives of David and Juliet, for example, or that Jim would always be a painter? Or that Jim, if not with Eva, would be attracted to Helena? Did you always know that you would have those characters follow those paths?
The short answer is no. I obviously won't leave you with a short answer, but I'm not a huge planner. It's a funny one. My husband laughs because in life, I'm quite a planner. So I really like working out what we're going to do on our holidays. And I really like to-do lists, and I like ticking things off on a list. But with writing, I'm much more sort of laissez-faire. So with this novel, obviously, I knew the structure was going to be a challenge, and I knew that I was going to have these three different versions of the same character's lives. So I did a degree of planning. I sat down, you know, the day after I'd had the idea, which was about 3 years ago now, and I thrashed out three really quite brief paragraphs, one for each version, giving a sense of where I thought the stories might go and how they might differ. And then I wrote a character description, a sort of A4 page for Eva and an A4 page for Jim, getting to know them a bit as you might describe, as an actor might prepare for a part, really. But I departed from that a lot as I wrote, and I didn't really know what would happen to David or Juliet or Helena or any. I didn't actually know Helena was going to appear at all until suddenly Jim was in Bristol in version two and met this woman in a room. So I left the characters a lot of freedom to make their own decisions and their own choices. And I think the best analogy I can think of to describe my intentions for that is the fact that in real life, obviously, with every day that we wake up, every conversation that we have no idea what's going to happen next. And it would be incredibly depressing, I think, if we did know. And I think fiction, for me anyway, needs to contain that element of surprise. We need to let our characters have the freedom to surprise us. And both Jim and Eva did surprise me frequently.
At the scene of Anton's birthday party in version one, I was surprised when Jim came up from behind and wrapped his arms around Eva, dancing to the music. I thought, what in the hell? And then I wondered how he got to the party before I remembered that it was version one. Was it difficult to keep the versions straight as you wrote them?
It probably was. It wasn't as difficult as it probably seems. I did have certain documents that I referred back to. So, I didn't plan meticulously, but I did keep documents, Word documents open as I was writing with key birth dates, key, you know, different children's names, key sort of differentiating incidents that would keep me straight. And occasionally I would make the same kind of confusion and use the wrong child's name or something in the first draft. But other than the small sort of what I would call technical slippages that I obviously corrected as I went along, the three paths did feel pretty distinct for me, and it wasn't too much of a challenge to keep them separate.
You mentioned children, and in the two versions where Eva marries David, they have completely different children with each other. And in fact, the variation in version three is different than one and two because Eva is already pregnant before the chance encounter with the rusty nail. How did you decide when the scenarios would deviate? I mean, the rusty nail wasn't the point of the lives going in three different directions because they had already gone in a different direction before the nail, at least in the part where in version three.
Sure, that's absolutely true. Yes. Although of course Eva doesn't know that yet. That it's you know, something has been set off, but she doesn't yet know. So as far as she and Jim are concerned in terms of meeting, then yes, the nail remains the inciting incident in versions one and three. But the thing that will throw them off course has already been set in motion. No, it's a very good question. I made certain decisions before I began writing about what I would allow to differ and what I would keep the same. Obviously, you know, I could have changed absolutely everything about everybody and every version, and I was sort of terrified of that because it seemed like we would have all been on a kind of mad carousel, like swirling round and round and round with no kind of focal points. So I did make decisions about ensuring that, you know, their friends and family remain the same in all versions, and generally speaking there aren't vast differences, say, in what's going on with Eva and Jim's parents. There are some, but more or less the really big important things, the birthdays, the deaths, the weddings, stay the same across all three. And the children differing was, I was aware that that was quite a daring decision on my part, that some people might take issue with that, might feel that that was a step too far in terms of exploring the different paths. But I think that came out of conversations that I actually had with my own mother from quite an early age, always quite lighthearted and funny, although it always sounds a bit funny when I retell it. But my mum and I are super close. My parents separated when I was young, and I'm very close to my dad too. But, you know, I grew up with my mum, and, you know, she was a single mum, so we spent a lot of time together. I'm an only child. And she used to joke to me about how easily I might never have been born. And she used to say that because she had had a boyfriend way before she met my dad, like 10 years before when she was quite young. And they had been engaged and they were planning to get married. And then he was offered a job actually in America, in New Mexico, in Albuquerque. And my mom just didn't want to move to the States. You know, it was a very different matter moving countries back then in the 60s. She would have been so far away from friends and family. And so she called off their engagement and didn't marry him. But I grew up with this sense that almost I was here by like the skin of my teeth, that it was so possible that my mom would have gone down a different path, and that I would either never have been born, or that I would have been born, but maybe she would have still called me Laura, but I would have looked different, I would have sounded different, I would have been American. So it always excited me. I didn't find it depressing or weird, really. I just found it exciting, this idea that we're all here by sort of a hair's breadth of chance.
Your book begins with two different stories of Jim and Eva's beginnings. So we know that they are our main two characters whose lives we follow as their paths cross. But even in version one, when the rusty nail is the beginning of their uninterrupted life together, it's not all roses and sunshine. Were you trying to make a point that sometimes the road not taken is just another lonely road? Or like in version two and three, you found yourself wondering, are they going to get together? When are they going to get together? Will they have a happily ever after? But in version one, it wasn't happily ever after from the beginning.
Sure. Yes, no, it's not. And I was very clear about that from the beginning. I knew I was going to be writing a love story, and I knew that it wasn't going to be your typical sort of cliched sentimental story, I guess, about, you know, will they, won't they, and then not taking into account what actually happens after they got together. I can't stand those stories where it's all about the pursuit, and then, you know, it's sort of the screen goes blank and it says the end, and we have to imagine they rode off into the sunset. Like, you and I, everybody listening, we know that's not how life is. That's not how love is. It's a complex, difficult, beautiful, but really quite hard thing that we all strive for and that we have to work at. And so, yeah, I definitely wanted to fly in the face of the conventions of romantic fiction, for sure. And give the reader a sense that version one initially might be the best version, the most perfect version, and then take that apart. Because the other objective I had very clear in my mind from the beginning was that I didn't want there to be one perfect version and the other two to be sort of pale facsimiles of that, because this isn't a novel in which there's one path, one fated way to be, and if the characters fall from that, then they're just kind of in the darkness forever. It's much more subtle than that. It's about making the best of our choices, whatever they are. And exactly as you say, you know, the path less traveled may not be a better path. It doesn't mean that because of this decision and we didn't meet that guy that our life is over and pointless and, you know, everything's dark and difficult. It's a matter of making the best of what we have and realizing that, you know, decisions have consequences and we just have to live with them.
The Versions of Us was published in the UK last year, and it will be published in the United States next month. How have the experiences differed in the two countries in terms of publication?
That's a very interesting question. And well, it's sort of all gearing up now for the US publication, but it's still a newer thing, obviously, for me than it is with the UK here. How has it differed? I would say it's actually much more similar than it is different. I've been very interested so far to discover that the majority of most influential publications in the US tend to be online now, and podcasts like this. I think there's a huge literary community online, isn't there? And I guess the US lends itself to that because it's such a huge country, and, you know, there isn't really one national paper in the way that we have here. So that's been very interesting. But in terms of talking to readers and booksellers and discussing the themes of the novel, I would say the remarkable thing really has been how much people have related to it all over the world. I mean, it's been sold into 24 different languages and published in 32 countries, I think, now. So, you know, many of those countries it's already out, and I'm getting messages from people in India and Pakistan and Australia and Germany and Holland. And, you know, it's just remarkable. It seems to be a very universal theme, which I guess I didn't even allow myself to dream of or really think about when I was writing it. It was just something that interested me. But the wonderful thing has been to discover that it seems to interest other people than just me as well.
You have worked as an arts journalist and a theater critic for The Guardian, The Observer, The Daily Telegraph, and Time Out London. Do you still write in that capacity?
I'm not doing so much anymore. I mean, it's been a slow sort of gradual process of change because, you know, publishing is quite slow. So, I mean, for instance, I signed the contract with Houghton in the US, you know, it's 18 months ago. So you kind of, you know, I didn't want to burn any bridges and give up contracts too early and see how it went. But, you know, it's gone really well in the UK. It's been a number one bestseller, and, you know, I've had another book to write. So I have rolled the journalism down, scaled it down, So yeah, but never say never, right? That's been a really important part of my life for a long time, so I wouldn't want to close it down completely. But fiction was my primary ambition, so I'm just thrilled to, you know, be able to earn my living doing that and spend my time doing that.
And you've written short stories, and this is your first novel, and you said you're working on another novel?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've actually just literally this week finished my first draft, ready to send off to my my British editor and my agent here.
What is your writing routine?
Well, I'm a morning person. I really irritate my husband because I wake up early and always want to talk to him, and he's always really sleepy because he's an owl and I'm a lark. So I wake up quite early and I go for a run usually, and then I come back, I get at my desk by about 9 a.m. and I write till lunchtime. Normally, if I'm in the middle of a book, I will spend the first hour or so going over what I wrote the day before, kind of getting myself back into the world of the novel, the world of characters. And then I will, generally speaking, have a sort of roughly thousand word target, but that will change. I'm not too rigid about that. And I write till lunchtime. I have the odd break. I drink a lot of coffee. I'm a fan of something called a flat white, which is very popular over here, although I think it's of limited kind of appeal in the US. I'm not sure it's hit everywhere yet. So I have flat whites and lots of sparkling water, and and I get on with it till lunchtime, and then in the afternoon I might come back and do more, or I might do some editing, or quite often I'm sort of exhausted. I can't generally write for longer than about 4 or 5 hours because it's very demanding. It takes a lot emotionally and physically as well.
I think I might have seen a flat white advertised somewhere, but how do you make a flat white?
Well, I have a machine that you press a button and it comes out. But basically, it's a double espresso shot with more or less the same amount of milk that you'd have in a cappuccino, but it's less steamed. So rather than putting in loads of steam, you basically heat the milk so that it's kind of velvety, but not all full of air. So it's like a really kind of flat, creamy, velvety cappuccino. I think they started in Australia. They're amazing.
I will have to try one.
That's my tip.
Sometimes when I visit with authors, they talk about what they were going to put in the book, but then they didn't, and then what was published was final. It's almost as though the publishing is what makes it real, that it makes the story come to life. In fact, I was visiting with an author one time, and I had read his advanced reader copy, and he said, well, there was a complete chapter in there that didn't make it into the ARC. You haven't read the real book. And so you wrote 3 different versions of a story, and they are all published. Does that mean they are all real?
That is such a good question. No one's asked me that yet. Are they all real? Yes, they are. They're equally real, which probably says as much about how mad I am as about anything else. I don't know. I mean, I completely know what you mean. I've been lucky because the editing with both my British and my American editors was what they call a sort of light edit. So nothing changed hugely from the first iteration to the final published copy. I extended the ending, which I'd kept sort of quite brief and elusive initially. And I won't say how, obviously, for listeners who haven't come to the ending yet, but both editors felt I needed a bit more sort of emotional weight. So, the novel, the published novel is the novel I originally wrote. Yeah, 3 stories, all of them equally real. So that's parallel universes for you.
Do you believe in destiny?
Oh, what a question. What a question. I don't know. I started writing the novel absolutely sure that I didn't, and that we shape our own fates entirely, that nothing is set in stone, and it's all down to us and to our decisions and to sort of random chance. Then I sort of got talking to my husband about that, and I think he was a bit surprised, because actually he is a big believer in fate and destiny and in the sort of inevitability of our meeting. So then obviously I felt like I sounded terribly unromantic. And writing the novel as well, you know, it was clear to me that there was this innate pull between Jim and Eva, that in whichever iteration, whichever version they met, they would feel this attraction. So the best way I can describe it now is to say that I don't believe in destiny in the sense of predestination. I certainly don't think our lives are mapped out and, you know, some divine entity knows where we're going and, you know, we just need to kind of trudge along the path. I find that really depressing. But I do think there is a pattern, a sort of degree of inevitability about certain things defined by our personality types, you know, the time and place that we're born, All of which probably leads me to say I'm a bit of a fence sitter about it. And the answer is sort of yes and no.
Do you have anything you'd like to add about the book that I have not asked?
Not really. I suppose just, I mean, maybe I should have mentioned just in terms of the experience of seeing it come out in the US that, you know, without meaning to sound sort of, I don't know, a bit sucky or sycophantic, there is just, there is something really special about seeing it come out in the States. It's a country that my husband and I are really fascinated by. We travel in the US a lot. We have family, or he has family in Maryland. And we're gradually trying to sort of tour our way around the States, you know, bit by bit. We've driven around New England, and we've driven Washington to New Orleans, which completely blew my mind. I think New Orleans is my favorite city anywhere in the world, just completely amazing. And we're planning the West Coast for next year. So, and I read a lot of American fiction, like most of my favorite authors, people like Anne Tyler, Elizabeth Strau, Richard Yates, John Irving, are American. There's a wonderful strain of American realism, which I find very emotionally true, very sort of compassionate. So there is a particular excitement for me in seeing the novel come out there and, you know, in American bookstores. Also, I really like American editions. They're a lovely size and a lovely design, and they generally have this lovely sort of matte cover. So I always, whenever I'm in the States, I stock up on books, and, like, you know, I have to buy like a second suitcase, and, you know, Virgin Atlantic gets really costing me my flight home. But it is just a real privilege to be coming out there, and I'm just super excited.
That was Laura Barnett speaking about her novel, The Versions of Us, which was published by HMH. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers. And I am the producer. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golbay.